welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. And brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and this is part two of my interview with Gary Fletcher. In part one, we followed Gary through his years as an apprentice, working on the building of the Upper Yarra Dam in Victoria, and learned how, at the age of 21, he began building up his own interstate trucking company. In this week's show, we learn that at the age of 40, Gary won a contract to build and maintain roads in Papua New Guinea, where he lived for some 30 years. Gary had many adventures, and in this show, we share one adventure where he was held up by thugs with a homemade shotgun, which fortunately misfired. We learn how Gary and his business partner were responsible for sending many young Papua New Guineans to school in Cairns. However, before listening to this PNG adventure, we pick up with Gary finishing his story about his experiences as the owner of a large trucking company and his experiences of dealing with police.
But we did have run-ins with, not run-ins with the police, that's the wrong description. Some of them were very good to us and we got along well with them, but and the police in those days frequently used transport drivers for information appertaining to stolen vehicles or, you know, wanted criminals and things like that, and they'd ask, and you know, the men that are most in those days, I don't know so much about today because they've got much faster trucks and they've got much less stopping areas, but they would show us photographs of wanted men.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, oh, yeah, I saw that bloke in Darwin at so-and-so, you know, and they say, oh, very good, thank you, you know. And this is how they got a lot of information from drivers that, you know, especially if they knew them personally, and asked them questions about certain blokes that were criminals that were wanted for questioning or something like that.
So the smart driver would really try and develop a relationship with the police.
Oh, of course, yes. They, you know, they, in those days, the drivers used to frequent, and we would lean on the police to get to use their telephone if you didn't have a, you know, quite a lot of those A and B telephone boxes were all that were in vogue in those days. You'd put 22 shilling pieces into them and all that sort of thing, but many of them didn't work properly, and of course if you wanted to ring up and say you'd broken down and all that sort of thing, the police would allow you to use their phone 24 hours a day, you know. They were quite reasonable with you, you know, and especially if they knew you and all that sort of thing, you know. And you know, you'd go to a police station to ask could you use the phone because the one in the post office didn't work or the vandals had terrorised it, you know. And it was quite an interesting occupation, yes, and you got used to it. And then travelling a lot all the time, you know, and that sort of thing. It was quite, you'd do about 70 or 80,000 kilometres a year and miles in those days.
Yeah, miles, I was going to say. Yes, that's a lot of kilometres.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Were you driving right up to the end, or did you gradually pull out of the driving and take...
I didn't do as much driving as the drivers did. No, certainly not. But I did a lot of... I owned the business and I was managing it, of course. And but I'd frequently go... if a driver got sick, I'd take it over and, you know, run a truck, especially if I had to go to places like capital cities collecting money that was owed to me and all that sort of thing. And I mean, I had a bank manager breathing down my neck, of course, you know. That was a bigger problem, you know.
Yes.
You couldn't write out any more checks, and if you're surprising, you know, the consumption of fuel was always high.
High overheads, really, right way down.
Oh, golly, yes. It carries sufficient fuel to do around about 1,200 or 1,500 kilometres, miles, I mean, in those days, you know, 1,200 miles from Melbourne to Brisbane. And when we were going to went across the desert to WA, you always carried fuel.
That's right. Well, it was, I mean, I went across there in the 70s and couldn't believe it when I paid the, I think it was the ungodly amount in those days of a dollar for a gallon.
Oh, yes.
And I couldn't believe how expensive that was, you know. In those capital cities, you were paying, you know, 40 cents a gallon or something. And
yes,
times have changed.
Something like the Nullarbor today is bitumen all the way.
That's right.
I can remember the days going across the Nullarbor Plain. It was 864 miles
of dirt,
red dust.
Oh, yes. I didn't quite drive it in that length, but I remember when we did hit the bitumen and I rolled it out, because I drove a small truck, and rolled up the back, and then this huge wave of dust just came straight out. I mean, I'll never forget that as long as I live. That was quite an adventure in those days, wasn't it?
Isn't it? Mm. Yes, you have to maintain your trucks by cleaning out the air cleaners first and changing the fuel filters, and it's hard work.
Yeah. Now, how did you go from trucking to New Guinea? What happened there? I
sold all the trucks to the drivers because Peter Stradling, my business partner, was an Englishman that was a very, very... You may not know this, but Sir Robert Menzies was once the Prime Minister of Australia, and he had three children. Now, the three children was Heather Menzies, the daughter, Brian Menzies, the chap that was the... Brian Menzies was the real estate agent here in Brighton, in Melbourne. But many people didn't know this. Sir Robert Menzies had another son. He was a very pleasant, well-educated, very well-qualified alcoholic. He did agriculture at one of the, I think, Dookie College near Shepparton. Ian Menzies was an absolute gentleman, well-educated and exceedingly friendly. Quite a gentleman, you know. I rather liked Ian, and I didn't meet his sister or his brother. But I did meet Sir Robert Menzies, and what my partner did, the English fellow, we lived at Murchison East when we were running the trucks, and we got to know him very well. And what Sir Robert Menzies did, he would buy a property, a sheep property, mm-hmm. and give it to his son, who would go and live on it, you see. And of course, he would mortgage the property. And his father would always lend him money to sort of assist him, you know. And he would make it pay. He did agriculture, and he was a man that knew how to grow wool. And, you know, he was a sheep man. And a lot of sheep farms up around Shepparton.
Of course, yep.
In that area. And anyway, one day he went to Canberra to have a talk to his father and borrow a bit more money, as everybody said. And it wasn't me that said that, it was a lot of other people. Anyway, he got to the lodge in Canberra, and they have people called the Federal Police in Canberra, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, two of these Federal Police said, "Excuse me, sir, what do you want?" And he'd had a few drinks on the way up to Canberra, hadn't he?
Oh.
And of course, this was told to everybody in the years gone by. And he said, who do you want to see in the lodge? He said, "My father." "Oh, who is your father?" "He's a Prime Minister."
"Oh, right, yes, sure."
They said, "You'd better come with us." So they took him up, and they were going to question him at the police station, and don't know what happened to his car, but they obviously got to take him back to the police station. And they found out that, yes, Ian Menzies was in actual fact the Prime Minister's son. So they took him back to the lodge, and he stayed with his father and everything else. But the way he told the story was very amusing, because he used to live at Murchison East, where I was renting a house at that time in the 60s. And Ian was a very, very friendly man, and a very heavy drinker. And he was knocking around with a couple of brothers that owned a property next to his. And they did quite well out of wool and sheep and everything. And he came into the hotel one night, and Peter Stradling, my English partner, and I used to go there to have an evening meal, because Mrs. Smith, who ran the hotel dining room, was an excellent chef. Her meals were just absolutely top. And George, her husband, was the publican. And Ian Menzies was there, and a group of people that were golfers. They'd been having a golfing tournament at Murchison East, you see, and the place was absolutely packed. And, of course, Ian was there, and, of course, he'd been at the hotel for several hours.
Oh.
And he came into the dining room dressed in his working gear, hadn't had a shower and a shave, and of course Ian turned around to him, and my partner was a very well-spoken Englishman, and he had a very audible voice, and he turned around to Ian and he said, "Look at you, Ian, you're a disgrace." He said, "Right at this moment, your father and mother are dining with Her Majesty at Glam's Castle in Scotland. And look at you." "Yes, Shrad, and I'm having dinner with you and Gary. Isn't that nice? Because I burst out laughing and so did everybody else. But, of course, the big question mark over the heads of all of the strange golfing fraternity was, who is he?
Is this
his mother and father are dining with Her Majesty? What are you talking about, you know? And, of course, then it came out that this other drunk who was a friend of his, haven't you met him? Oh, his old man's the Prime Minister.
Oh, dear.
And, of course, we were just, I was just, I thought, oh, my goodness, you know. And the story about going up to Canberra and getting the money from me, little things like that were part of them.
Down in Petersburg, everything's fine. All them cats is drinking that wine. Drinking that mess is their delight. When it gets rough, start singing all night. Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Pass that bottle to me. Drinking that mess is their delight. When it gets rough, start fighting all night. Knocking down windows and tearing down doors. Drinking half gallons and calling for more. Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Pass that bottle to me. Love sweet wine. Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Drink wine, sporty, oldie, drink wine.
Mop, mop.
Pass that bottle to me.
You said you sold your trucking company to the drivers? Or
yes, the drivers bought them. Yeah.
Right, so.
And I won a car. It was my association with Peter Stradling's association with Sir Robert Menzies that got us a contract on Bougainville Island with CRA. You may not know this, but Sir Robert Menzies, when he was the Prime Minister, he had an office in 95 Collins Street, Melbourne. And it belongs to CRA, Consinc Rio Tinto of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of Ian Menzies that I met the mining engineer manager of Bougainville Copper. in Papua New Guinea.
Right.
And I got a job up there building... Building the roads.
Oh, okay. Road construction.
Yeah, on Bougainville Island. They were building a road from the east coast of Bougainville Island up into the mountains where the copper mine was to be established.
How long was that road, roughly?
About 47 kilometres.
Through some pretty treacherous terrain,
I think. Very treacherous. Vertical real estate, I call it.
Vertical real estate. Yes. So how long were you there for?
2 years.
2 years.
Yes, that and must we have put, been all we did, we put the access road in. Right. And then that was, once they could drive four-wheel drives up there, that's all they wanted. And so then I managed to start tendering for contracts in the mainland of Papua New Guinea, and I went to the southern highlands of it, that's the western part that joins onto the border with Indonesia.
Right.
In the southern highlands of Papua New Guinea, and West Irian, if you like, that's the place it's called.
Roughly what year was this? Where were we at?
This was in 1972. I went to Bougainville, yes.
So was it pretty quiet politically at that stage?
Oh, yes. It was still under the control of Australia.
All right, okay.
Yes, it was a very, very beautiful country. There was no crime and it was lovely. Yes, it really was good.
So how long did you live in Papua New Guinea for?
34 years.
That's
from 1968 I first went there.
Right.
Yes, until just 2 years ago.
And what was your main... I mean, what direction were you? What were you doing for most of that time?
Always connected with building of roads and road maintenance. Yes,
goodness,
and all over the country, mainly in the. I worked in the Madang province for quite a bit. Did a couple of hundred kilometres of road there, and I built roads in the eastern highlands of Papua New Guinea, and also in the Chimbu province of Papua New Guinea, and also the western highlands.
Right.
And I was in the Southern Highlands for about a year and a half. A little bit, many, many roads. I should have added up all the, how many kilometres of roads I've built, but it's a hell of a lot.
Heck of a lot. Yeah, I bet it is too.
I'd have to think about how far they were, yes.
Did you have any trouble adapting to the climate and the weather?
No, not really. It was quite good. The weather in Bougainville was worse. And you get bitten alive by mosquitoes, of course, and malaria is a very serious problem out there. I did get malaria quite a few times, but when I went to live in the highlands, there's no malaria mosquitoes up there because you're above 5,000 feet.
Oh, okay.
And the mosquitoes can't stand it, you see.
Right, right.
And it was much safer. When you went to the coast, be it Madang or Sepik, which the north coast is Wewak, that's in the Sepik province, and Madang, which is in the Madang province, and Lae, which is in the Morobe province. And then, of course, you've got go around further into the Port Moresby, of course, is the capital of the whole country. That's where the headquarters of the parliament are. And then you go further around into the western provinces, like down the south, you know. But I didn't go into the south area. I was in the Port Moresby region. I won a contract there in what's called the Central Province, maintaining the highway that was built by Kirpin Brothers many years previously, and I won the contract to maintain it was 83 kilometres of road that had to be maintained. It was constant rain and very heavy, graders, rollers, water trucks, that sort of equipment. And then I built the road from there, the end of that road, which was in a place called Barina, and I built a road from there at a place called Arapakina up into the highlands, joining up with a place where, and we built an airstrip there, which was a beautiful airstrip. It was on about a 1 in 7 gradient. It was like that.
Wow. So you must have been in some fairly remote areas.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, yes.
So what sort of relationship did you develop then with the local inhabitants?
Oh, quite good. Yeah, the first thing to do is to learn to speak pidgin, and that's what I learned, to speak pidgin and a bit of Motu and Kuanua. Kuanua is spoken by the people of East New Britain. Motu is spoken by the people of the Central Province, which is where the capital city is, Port Moresby. And pidgin is spoken right through the whole country.
Mm.
Mainly in the highlands is where I lived, and they all spoke pidgin there, but they also speak their own dialect, which is a different language again, but Pidgin has spoken pretty openly right through the whole country.
Now, I mean, in the time left, there's absolutely no way I could expect or ask you to tell us everything that happened in Papua New Guinea, but in 37 years, there must be some things that just stand out in your mind. What comes to mind?
Well, have you ever seen a handmade shotgun?
No.
It's a piece of water pipe with a 12-gauge cartridge inside it, sliding
sounds
inside
deadly.
A bigger piece of water pipe with a nail welded into
great.
It, you see. And they put rocks as big as that armchair you're sitting on across the road. And you come along in your car in the late evening or dark, and you've got a great big couple of rocks in front of you, and you can't drive the car over the top of them, so you have to stop. They demand money from you. There's probably 50 of them, or 20, or thereabouts. Thugs, criminals. And if you haven't got any money, or you tell them you haven't got any money, they put the gun barrel against your head like that, and they bring that one up, and it blows your head off. Well, there's the marks that it leaves when it doesn't go off.
Oh, goodness.
And there's 36 pellets still in my hip where it did go off. Your face has lost a bit of its charm.
I'm just not quite sure how to deal with that. That's not what I was expecting.
Well, that happened to me in 1988. I featured on the front page of the paper. What's the date on that, 88?
Okay, Gary's just given me a copy of a local newspaper, New Guinea News, spelled N-I-U-S, and businessman escapes death in Highlands armed hold-up. Paragon Earth Moving Company owner Gary Fletcher pictured is recovering from shotgun pellet wounds in his Goroka home after narrowly escaping death. Good Lord. Did that not make you want to pack up and go home?
Well, the thought crossed my mind, but of course I had to run the business, and I was building roads. And
were you married? Did you?
I had several run-ins with marriages, yes, but not marriage such.
Okay. So there was no partner at this stage to be.
No, only Peter Stradling, my business partner.
Right,
but he was murdered up there.
He was murdered.
1999, yes, September 99, they murdered him in his own home.
How absolutely tragic!
Mm.
How sad!
Terrible.
So it's
business partner for 40 years, you know.
That must have been very distressing. Just
that's
so
why I got out.
Mm,
that's what I just said. That's it. I sold all the machines and sold the trucks and the. And I've rented the properties out, and it's an exciting place.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think it gives a whole new meaning to the definition of the word exciting. That was a tragic thing, and what happened to you was very tragic. I bet you there were moments or times when there were as many untragic things happening.
Oh, absolutely.
Wonderful time.
There were most enjoyable things happened. Wonderful things happened, you know. I trained a lot. Peter and I sent a lot of kids to the All Souls and St Gabriel's School in Cairns, you know, and we really did look after them, you know. It was quite amazing, you know, and they succeeded. One of them's a very famous Papua New Guinean doctor.
That's nice to know that you.
Yes, it's good,
isn't it,
when you send them here. Charters Towers is where that very famous school is. It's called All Souls and St Gabriel's.
Yes. Yes.
And it's a very successful school. They had a marvellous reputation for putting many Papua New Guineans through schools. It's expensive, but it's exceptionally good. And every child that I put through, Peter and I put through All Souls and St Gabriel's, have succeeded in everything they did.
Excellent.
Famous doctors, famous nurses, matrons of the hospitals, two of them, and very, very, and civil engineers, accountants, everything you could think of. We put many, many of those kids through schools, and their parents are forever grateful to me and Peter for what we did, you know.
I think that must be an amazing thing for you to have experience and for you to sit back and reflect on, knowing that you've not just left your mark in terms of infrastructure, but that you've actually reached out and touched people and got their lives, not only their lives on track, but they've probably in turn now touching people and getting and helping them.
I get Christmas cards, birthday cards by the truckload. And, you know, it's amazing. They still make sure they keep in touch with you. And they plead with me to come back to Papua New Guinea. But, of course, I've retired now, you know.
So what's life now like now you're retired? I mean,
well, I do need the rest. I think, you know, I've built roads. I've built hundreds and hundreds of kilometres of roads all over the mainland of Papua New Guinea and Bougainville and East New Britain and West New Britain, and and a good friend of mine still lives in, he lives up in Cairns now. He owned a company over there, and he's been here and stayed here with me. Richard Wiltshire is his name, and he started his career. His father was a famous Sydney lawyer, a corporate lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard, his father knew, the story is interesting about Richard. He's another one of the colonial type, you know. Well educated, went to school and that, and he got on a boat whose captain was a friend of his father. And he went to Papua New Guinea with this boat.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't go home again. And he eventually, his distraught parents, his father was a famous Sydney lawyer,
right,
and a well-known man, you know, not just a, yeah, you know, yeah, not a man, and of course missing in action, so to speak, and all this. However, he got in touch with his parents eventually, and all was forgiven. He developed a successful business in Papua New Guinea, and he was only a teenager when he went there.
Sounds like something out of an old boy's own manual, doesn't it? It really does.
The Somerset Maugham, yes, story, yes, indeed. Yes, it was rather interesting. But I went there legally, you know, like, and so did Richard. He now lives in Cairns. He's a nice chap.
So one day, the inevitable day comes for us all, we pass on.
Mm.
When that day comes from you, for you, how would you like to be remembered?
As a good friend.
That's probably a very nice thing to be remembered for, isn't it? A good friend. And that's probably a good place for us to finish.
I think so.
Gary, thank you very much for inviting me into your home and sharing your life.
No worries at all. It's been a pleasure having you, yes.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.